morning, everybody. Thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be able to share with you some work that we've done looking at the potential role for school mandates to influence vaccine uptake rates for HPV. I think everybody in this audience is pretty well convinced that HPV vaccination is a good thing and has a potential role for impacting HPV-related diseases significantly. Previous work has suggested that if HPV vaccines were widely utilized by the majority of the adolescent population, we might see a reduction in cervical cancer cases by 70 to 80% and a reduction in genital warts by 80 to 90%. And some epidemiologic evidence also suggests that widespread use of this vaccine would lead to reductions in vulvar and vaginal cancers by perhaps 60 to 80% and penile cancers by 40 to 60%. Now, the way that most of these estimates about the impact of HPV vaccination have been derived have been through the use of what are known as mathematical modeling studies. And essentially, what these studies do is they take all of the published data about the incidence of HPV infection and the probability that infection would lead to a clinical disease like cervical or penile cancer, and put all of these pieces of data into a gigantic mathematical formula that can then be used to answer a variety of questions. So one of the fundamental questions is about the natural history of HPV infection in the population. So what might the burden of HPV-associated diseases look like in the future if we were to do nothing different than what we are currently doing today? And then once we understand better the natural history of HPV infection, we can then use these models to address questions about the potential impact of HPV vaccination and also about how HPV vaccination might impact cervical cancer screening guidelines and how the guidelines might be changed in a cost-effective manner. There's now been quite a few models developed about HPV infection and HPV vaccination, and although the models differ somewhat in how they are developed and put together and somewhat in the outcomes that they report, they pretty much all suggest that there's a high impact of HPV-related clinical outcomes following widespread implementation of the HPV vaccine. However, these previous models do have some limitations, and one of the important limitations of the models is that they may actually represent what I call the best case scenario for vaccination. And the reason for this is twofold. First of all, these previous models about HPV vaccination really assume that vaccine uptake is very comprehensive. So most models assume 100% uptake by the eligible population. Some of the models go down to even as low as 70%. And there's really only one or two of these models that go below 70% vaccine uptake in the population. The second limitation is that they assume instantaneous vaccine uptake, or at least near instantaneous vaccine uptake. So what we're talking about here when we're looking at these models to figure out what are the potential impacts on clinical diseases from HPV vaccination, the models are assuming that the vaccine is taken up by almost all the population as soon as the vaccine is available for public use. Now, obviously, these assumptions about instantaneous and near widespread or universal uptake are not really realistic. I think most of us probably recognize this from our own experience with adolescents, either of our own children or within our clinical practices. But there's also a lot of data to support that these assumptions are not realistic. For example, we know that adolescents are one of the age groups of children that are somewhat least likely to access preventive care services where immunizations tend to be preferentially provided. And in fact, one study showed that there was only about a third of 12 to 21-year-old adolescents who had had a well child exam or a preventive health-focused exam in the previous year. There's also a variety of parental and patient characteristics that might impact reluctance for HPV vaccination. So, for example, parents have concerns that consenting to HPV vaccination might be sending the wrong message to their adolescent about their views on sexuality. The high cost of the HPV vaccine has led many people to feel the financial constraints if they are under or uninsured for the vaccine. Many parents have concerns about the long-term safety and the long-term efficacy of the vaccine and want to wait a few years until the vaccine has been more widely utilized before they go ahead and have their daughter vaccinated. And then finally, a consideration that I think is consistent across all the adolescent vaccines is that sometimes the adolescent just doesn't want to be vaccinated. So unlike a two-month-old where the parent is really the primary person in charge of deciding whether or not the vaccine is given, for an adolescent vaccine like HPV, it has to really be a shared decision between the adolescent and the parent and the provider. So what all of these pieces of data mean is that the previous models that look at the impact of HPV vaccination on clinical outcomes may have in fact overestimated their impact because of the assumptions about widespread and instantaneous uptake of the vaccine. And so what our group sought to do was to actually make a new mathematical model that was a little bit more realistic in terms of what we might expect for HPV vaccine uptake among the population of adolescents. And we wanted to populate our model with existing data that is now fairly abundantly available, looking at parental attitudes about HPV vaccines and also on adolescent healthcare utilization patterns, with the understanding that adolescents use preventive care services less frequently than other childhood age groups. And we focused our model specifically on parents of 11 to 17-year-old girls, because when you're under age 18, it's really important that your parent is the one who is in charge of the vaccination decision, because they must consent to having the vaccine be applied in the majority of cases. And what we did was we created a model to do two goals. The first one was to explore kind of what we thought might be the baseline utilization of the vaccine in the population given the current conditions, and then also to use the model to explore the potential impact of school mandates for HPV vaccination on future HPV vaccine use. This diagram shows a conceptual model of how we thought parents might be impacted by a variety of factors in their decision to vaccinate. And what you can see here is that the main driver of vaccination is the parent's intention or motivation to vaccinate. And vaccination intention is influenced primarily by parental attitudes, which include a variety of things, such as their general and specific beliefs about health, their previous experience and knowledge, their previous decisions and the outcomes of those decisions, social influences like the views of their peers, and sociodemographic factors that we know are associated with higher or lower immunization rates. Parental attitudes are also influenced by the attitude of their adolescent and by the influence of cost on their decision, as well as by the physician's attitudes. And once the parent decides to intend to vaccinate their child, they then have to go to additional step where they actually have to go to a setting where they're able to access the vaccine, so for example, a medical provider. And it's only at that point that they receive the vaccination. Accessing the vaccine in our model was also influenced by physician attitudes, which could impact whether or not the provider decides to make the vaccine available, which could influence the accessibility to the vaccine. And our model was based on some well-validated theories of health behavior, such as the health belief model, and shown at the bottom here also the stages of change model. When we modeled the impact of school mandates, we had school mandates have an impact at a variety of different levels on parental attitudes, with the idea of thinking that many parents would be more motivated to get their child vaccinated if it was required for school, and also on physician attitudes, with the understanding that physicians might be more likely to recommend the vaccine if they knew that schools required it, and this could also influence whether or not the provider made the vaccine available. So I hope hopefully this provides you a little bit of a framework of how we sort of designed our model, at least conceptually. In terms of actually implementing the model, you can think of the model as existing in several different mutually exclusive compartments. So parents, as they go through the model, are existing in one of these compartments and can move between compartments over time. Initially, parents enter the model into one of three compartments. They're either blissfully unaware of the HPV vaccine and therefore have no opinions about it. They're aware of the HPV vaccine and think it's a good idea and want to have their daughter vaccinated, or they're aware of the vaccine and decide, for whatever reason, that they just don't really want their daughter vaccinated. Over time, parents can move between these three compartments, or they can also move to two additional compartments, which is where they have a visit with a medical provider, and after that visit, they've decided that they either do or do not want to have their daughter vaccinated. And it's only in the setting of having a medical visit and wanting the daughter vaccinated that they can go ahead and get the first dose. And then in our model, after the first dose, they have to make a decision again of whether or not they want or don't want the second dose. And if they want it, they can go ahead and get it under certain circumstances. And then a similar pattern applied for getting the third dose. In terms of the model dynamics, we initially populated our model with parents of 11 to 17-year-old girls. And over a 50-year time horizon, we continually had a new influx of unvaccinated 11-year-olds entering the model. Parents could exit the model by three methods. Either their daughter could receive all three doses of the vaccine, their daughter could turn 18 and therefore no longer require parental consent for vaccination, or they could die, which was a rare occurrence since the death rate applied to this age group was very low. And as I mentioned, we modeled a HPV vaccine utilization over a 50-year time horizon. Now, as with any model, our model had to have some assumptions, and these can be considered limitations to interpretation of our model. One of the major key assumptions in this model is that the parents that we modeled were homogeneous, and this is not really a realistic assumption. So for the purpose of this initial model where we were starting to develop this methodology to address some of these questions, we took the simplest approach, which was that parents of 11-year-olds would act the same way as a parent of a 17-year-old. And there's a lot of data to support that this may not actually be true. So future iterations of this model will try to delve into that complexity a little bit more. We also had to make decisions about the relative influence of different factors on parental attitudes about the vaccine. So, parental consent for vaccination. So these included things like their personal attitudes, physician recommendation, normative beliefs, and costs. And we made decisions about which of those might be more important at any time step in the model. And then finally, we modeled HPV mandates that could be considered similar in terms of their strength to previous vaccine-related mandates. But if you actually look at the legislative process that's going on right now across the states, many of the states are actually considering HPV vaccine-related school mandates that are not as strong as the mandates that we modeled. For example, several states have mandates that require only that parents receive information about the HPV vaccine, but not that the adolescent actually gets the vaccine. So getting on to some data, this is a graph looking at the cumulative percent of the eligible cohort that's vaccinated. That's the y-axis over here. And on the x-axis is this 50-year time horizon. The dark blue line is the first dose, pink is second dose, and light blue is third dose. And what our model is showing here under non-mandate vaccine conditions is that after the first year, our model predicted that 25% of the population would receive the first dose, 17% would have received two doses, and 7% of the population would have received all three doses. After 10 years, about 57% of the population was estimated to have received three doses, and it wasn't until 23 years that we actually reached that 70% threshold that previous modeling studies looking at the impact of HPV vaccines on clinical outcomes had used. And finally, maximal vaccine utilization for all three doses wasn't achieved until the final year that we modeled in our study and was at a level of 78% for 3 years. Now, before this model was, the results came out for the model, but as we were developing it, the NIS teen study was being conducted across the U.S. that looked at national HPV immunization rates among 13 to 17-year-olds. And we were very happy when the results came out because you can see that their results for HPV vaccine uptake among 13 to 17-year-olds actually very well matched the results from our model, which are shown here in yellow. So that was a good indication that at least the way that we had designed the model and maybe some of the assumptions that we had made may be reasonable given that they seem to mimic the current conditions of HPV vaccine utilization. This is a similar diagram now looking at the same conditions but under the setting of HPV vaccine mandates. So in this model, if a mandate had been implemented at the same time that the HPV vaccine had been rolled out, our model predicted that instead of 7% vaccine coverage by the end of year one, we would have 19% of girls fully vaccinated. And that the 70% threshold that we might reach would occur at 8 years instead of 23 years, as was modeled in the non-mandate conditions. Maximal vaccination, which actually occurs at 43 years, was 91%, which was higher than the 78% found in the non-mandate conditions. And so, as I mentioned, we had a lot of assumptions in our model, and we do a technique called sensitivity analysis that tries to look at the relative impact of these various assumptions on our model outcomes. And what we found was that our model was generally stable to these assumptions, that the most influential uncertainties in our model were the relative weight we assigned to the effect of cost on parental attitudes and the initial probabilities that we set for the percent of parents who are uninformed about the vaccine. So from our model, I think we can draw several conclusions. First of all, our model was consistent with the first year of data collection on HPV vaccine utilization by adolescents, which is obviously a good thing. And this suggests that perhaps assumptions in previous models looking at the impact of HPV vaccination on clinical outcomes may have been too generous. Under baseline conditions, our model suggested that vaccine utilization will be suboptimal for quite a while and that coverage of even 70% levels will take decades to achieve. In our model, mandates did seem to help increase both the rate of uptake and the maximal level of use, but there was still going to be at least somewhat of a delay before high utilization levels were achieved. Limitations of our study is that obviously the assumptions we made can have somewhat of an impact on our results, and one of the big ones is that we didn't account for much heterogeneity in behaviors amongst parents, so that will be some of the future studies that we plan to do. We also simulated mandates that were stronger than many of the proposed mandates, so in some ways our model represents kind of a best case scenario of what we might expect mandates to do. And also, we only modeled HPV vaccination among adolescents. Obviously, women who are 18 years or older are still eligible to receive the vaccine and are a very important component of HPV vaccination programs. So our next steps is try to link some of our endpoints to a natural history model of HPV so we can get a sense of what our results might mean in terms of clinical outcomes, and then also to use a new type of modeling strategy called agent-based modeling to be able to incorporate some of these heterogeneities that we think are important factors influencing behavior and motivation for vaccination. So thank you very much to my collaborators and the University of Michigan, and thanks for attending my talk.
Have some time if there are any questions for Dr. Dempsey. Okay, please go to the mic because this is being recorded.
Thank you.
Hi, Cindy Rand from the University of Rochester. Hi. I just wondered, in terms of the visit rate for well child care, did you assume 35% for 11 to 18 year olds?
Yeah, we did. And that was a very simplifying assumption in our model. I mean, I think, as you're well aware, there's variability in terms of percent of kids that go to the doctor that varies by age. So that's another thing that we're planning on incorporating in the next stages of this model. This was really just a first pass attempt to get some broad brushstroke ideas of what might be happening, and the next steps will be to incorporate some of these things that we know pretty well, have been well documented as being differences based on age, race, other demographic factors.
Great, because I think it'd be really different if you look at the 11 to 13 year olds, and you know, self-report, they say maybe 80% are actually having a preventive visit,
right.
And then if you look at records, it's more like 35%.
Yeah, there's
so maybe giving estimates all the way in between.
Yeah, we did do a pretty wide range of sensitivity analyses on the actual rate of vaccine of preventive care utilization among adolescents. So we varied it over a pretty wide range. I don't think it went up to 85%, but it was like maybe 70%. So
it looked better, hopefully, within the first couple
slightly, of but not as much as you might think. It seemed like some of these other factors were more important.
Okay, thanks.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Mikhail Maddox, I'm the Physician Director of Immunizations at Maxwell Air Force Base. My question is in relationship to some of my very well-informed parents are actually requesting HPV vaccine for their male children. And this is because men are relying on herd immunity. And some of my well-informed patients, and again, these are active duty military and TRICARE beneficiaries, so they pay nothing for their vaccine, are interested in having their male children vaccinated. And I haven't been able to find good data, and I don't have good answers for them. Is there anything that's being done to consider increasing herd immunity by decreasing the propagation of HPV in men?
Yeah, that's one of the like million-dollar questions that's out there right now is, are we going to vaccinate men, and if so, who and under what circumstances? Actually, a few months ago, they released information about vaccine efficacy in males at one of the European STD conferences that showed that the quadrivalent vaccine was highly efficacious in preventing anogenital lesions associated with the HPV types in the vaccine in men. So that was a big step towards potentially getting FDA approval for HPV vaccine use in men in this country. And I should also point out that the HPV vaccine is approved for men in some other countries like Australia, for example. So there's precedent for having HPV vaccination in men. It hasn't happened in this country yet, but there's certainly a lot of work of people trying to get towards that goal. If that does happen, then I think the bigger question becomes, you know, who's going to pay for it and at what ages are we going to pay for it? And I think a lot of those questions are still being worked out. So in your situation where vaccines might be covered, it might not be so much of an issue, but in terms of the broader public health questions about male HPV vaccination, I think it is a really active issue and one that these modeling studies are trying to address, looking at the cost effectiveness of male vaccination, including males in the vaccine process, as opposed to just vaccinating females.
Are you seeing a lot of physicians that are actually doing a non-FDA-approved usage of vaccinating boys?
Well, we've looked at a little bit about vaccine uptake of the HPV vaccine within our clinic population and have seen a few cases of male HPV vaccination. If you look at some of the more national studies, there are showing that, you know, a small proportion, 1-2% of the vaccine is being uptaken by males. So it's happening, not at a very high level, it appears, but obviously there's some interest, especially among some of the higher risk groups like men who have sex with men, for example.
Thank you.
Lori Markowitz from CDC. Thank you. It was a very nice presentation. I actually wanted to address the previous question and provide a little information about that. Merck has submitted their application to FDA for a licensure of the HPV vaccine in boys. That was submitted in December. And we understand that FDA will have about 10 months to review that application. So advisory groups are considering this, and we're anticipating within the next year that ACIP will be looking at this and considering whether or not it should be recommended for boys. So that is certainly on the agenda.